Well, hey there. Welcome to The Real Podcast. We share the stories and insights of real people that challenge your mind and inspire you to grow. For more information and resources, check out our website at CochraneAlliance.com/real. So, let's get real.
All right. Welcome back to another episode of Real. And today we are going to talk a little bit about what happens in communities after disasters and how an organization and in particular a person is involved in helping communities recover after something catastrophic goes on in their community. I don't know if it's just me, but it seems that every year now in Canada, we're hearing about a disaster striking some part of our country. It's probably always been, but I don't know if it's climate change or better news coverage, but there always seems to be something going on, whether that is in recent memory, the Fort McMurray fires of 2016, the wildfires in BC in the summer of 2018 that burned more area than any other season in the province's record, the flooding in BC's interior a little bit later or a little bit earlier than that. And then, of course, as we're recording this, lots of news out of Eastern Canada and New Brunswick, Ontario, Quebec, where rivers are flooding and a lot of communities in distress. Samaritan's Purse is an organization that many people know or are familiar with as a as an organization that is there to respond to disasters. Maybe more of us know it as the organization that hands out shoeboxes to boys and girls who live overseas. But Samaritan's Purse is also an organization that serves people in North America when disaster strikes their community. And they have, for many years now in the United States and Canada, mobilized specialized staff and equipment and hundreds of volunteers and move into a community to help. They provide emergency aid and help with cleanup in the wake of severe wildfires or floods or hurricanes or tornadoes. They are have a well-equipped and well-trained rapid response team of chaplains who can be deployed to pray and to meet people who are struggling and probably going through an incredible amount of loss. And then something a little bit newer, once the initial crisis is over, SP stays involved in these communities, looking at the complex task of rebuilding and recovering after that disaster. And for the past, well, maybe it's almost been 2 years, a member of my congregation here in Cochrane, Steve Gross, has been serving with Samaritan's Purse as their National Recovery Program Manager. And I've been so interested to hear of the stories that he's been telling, of what he's doing, and I've told him that someday I'm going to talk to you in some form and get those stories out. So finally, today, we are going to talk about it on Real. So Steve, welcome to the Real Studio.
Hello, thanks, Jason. Good to be here.
So your business card says that you are the National Recovery Program Manager with Samaritan's Purse. Tell us, what does that mean exactly?
Well, what that means exactly is very hard to describe because, as you said before, it's very complex. Recovery is a whole different animal than response. It's pretty easy in a response in the sense that it's easy to identify what's gone on, what immediately needs attention and rectification, and moving forward on that path. So it happens in a relatively short period of time. Recovery is a different animal in the sense that a lot of people think that it's about rebuilding, but recovery is actually very, very complicated and covers more than just the physical losses that have occurred. So it's something that Samaritan's Purse has evolved into through our experience in Fort McMurray. We did some recovery work in southern Alberta in the floods. And most of that was around...
This is the Calgary floods of like 2013?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, that was our first big experience on a scale that we were there for over 3 years involved in recovery with repair work, and we even went to the point of one rebuild.
So maybe back us up. So what's on the table right now in the news as we're recording this is what's going on in Eastern Canada. These floods in New Brunswick, for instance, with the rapid response, what does Samaritan's Purse do? Once the floodwaters recede, what could a community that's experiencing this, what could they expect from you guys?
Typically, we get involved after something like this, and really in a disaster, there's two types of losses. There's insured or insurable losses and uninsured or uninsurable losses. Mm-hmm. And that, to some degree, dictates how we get involved, because if they're insurable losses, the insurance company typically wants to look after these things on their own. So there may be a role for us to play depending on the magnitude of what's gone on, but typically it's uninsurable. Most floods anymore tend to be uninsurable with the changes in how
insurance... This is what my insurance company tells me is overland flooding. They're not responsible.
They claim that. They also maintain that if you have water that has come back through your floor drain anymore, they are no longer looking at it as a sewage backup, but it is now, if you don't have a black backflow valve, you're going to have to provide additional insurance at an additional premium to look after those kind of repairs.
So most basements in Canada, probably, you guys could be a useful resource.
Yeah. Yeah, recover backflow valves are a real big thing. They put them in most places anymore. It's a pretty cheap install at time of construction. It's quite a bit more work if you try to install it after the fact.
Okay.
Yeah. So we would get involved in the majority of these. It will be around stripping all of the impacted area around with the building materials, carpets, flooring, if that's required, depending on whether it's what is termed as clean water or whether it's got some sewage, then it may require a deeper tear out than if it's clean water. But removing drywall insulation, all those things, up usually 4 feet, depending on how high the floodwaters have risen. And then using a sanitary spray to clean everything. So, I mean, obviously then before you can do all those things, everything has to be removed from the house. And depending on whether it can be salvaged or whether it's going to be disposed of, then it's either moved to the curb or tried to move somewhere where it can be cleaned and then repurposed back into the home.
So how many volunteers can you, how many people are ready to go to do this kind of stuff? Like 50, 100? How many could you mobilize?
Well, our volunteer roster is 4,000.
Cross-country?
Cross-Canada.
And are these people willing, are there people in BC that are ready to go to New Brunswick?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, they will come from all over. But typically because we partner so closely with a local church, we usually, most of our volunteers will come from there. Our site leadership teams we will bring in because they've got the experience to ensure that the people have proper documentation, proper training, and safety is obviously a paramount concern all the time. So we want to make sure that we're equipping our people with the proper protective equipment as well as with the training they need to be safe in all these circumstances. So it usually on a daily basis, depending on how many day volunteers we have, we could have up to 100 on a day.
Okay. So, but that's a disaster response. But my understanding is that's actually not your primary snack bracket. You're on recovery. So what is the difference between disaster response and recovery?
Well, as I said earlier, response is typically getting in there, cleaning up the obvious things, and then we pull our equipment and folks out. Recovery is a different animal because it is very long term. Most of the research indicates that recovery is 2 to 10 years, depending on the individual, on their circumstances, on what resources they have in place in terms of financial resources, family resources, community resources. So it's really a matter of going in and assessing and trying to find the people, depending on the type of disaster it's been. I've kind of, my experience tells me in the last 2.5 years, there's basically 4 different types of disasters, and then the recovery looks different in each one of them. So it's a matter of going in, trying to assess what style of disaster it was, and therefore then what the recovery is going to look like. Because Fort McMurray, as an example, we're still involved there in recovery, is radically different than what we're doing in Williams Lake in the interior of BC from 2017.
Both forest fires,
but in Williams Lake, the community itself wasn't impacted other than having been evacuated for 3 weeks, which is traumatic in itself. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have a loss in the community. So most of the people who lost homes or outbuildings were rural. And often they tended to live off the grid. So in other words, they were trying to fly under the radar. They weren't intentionally looking to be in a community. So they then didn't know really in a lot of ways how to access resources or anything else. So we spent quite a bit of time in that one. We're still active there. I've still got 2 case managers working there. And it's a matter there of going out and finding the people before you can actually even help them on their path to recovery.
Okay. So as the recovery guy, are you there right when the fires are burning or the rivers are flooding, or do you wait for a month until that initial response is done?
I will usually go in during the response phase, because what I want to do is I want to get involved in the emergency operations center, find out who the players are, understand what they have that is going to take them, because the whole approach to recovery is relatively new in Canada. I would say it's in the last probably 3 to 5 years that there's been anything done. And there's very little at a provincial level and nothing at a national level that is engaged in recovery. So the provinces are beginning to move down those paths. We've actually, Alberta was the first with a recovery arm that is under their ministry that specifically deals with these kind of things. So it's evolving in BC. I've been in meetings with them trying to encourage them around the kind of things that they need to do based on what we've learned in the other recovery actions that we've been engaged in, because we've been involved in them all across Canada, from the floods in New Brunswick last year to the tornadoes to the flooding in Grand Forks last year as well, and then with the wildfires and in 2016 in Fort McMurray, 17 in Williams Lake and the Caribou, and then in 2018 the fires in Dease Lake, Telegraph Creek area were still active up there, as well as around Burns Lake and Fraser Lake. We've been just recently asked to look at going back in there again.
And it's the provincial government that's asking you to come?
Yes.
Or the local communities?
We get asked often by both. We get invited in typically. We've established a good reputation with folks from at the provincial level. We're engaged with them on their NGO councils that they have put in place to ensure that they're aware of what each of the NGOs is able to provide and the capacity they have to be engaged in and contribute in the disaster and then going forward into the recovery.
Hmm. Okay, so there's lots of like interesting things we want to delve in on community and stories of what you're doing, but maybe let's back up for a second to Steve Gross, the guy. Aside from this professional role that you hold currently with the Samaritan's Purse, who are you? Tell us a little bit about your life and from what I know, being involved in disaster recovery work wasn't your day job for most of your life.
No, it hasn't been my day job for most of my life, but I've been involved with Samaritan's Purse since 1993 in a variety of different contexts in Southeast Asia, in South America, Central America, in Africa, in the Middle East, in Greece with the evacuees that the refugees that were leaving through Turkey. So I've been involved in a lot of different ways with them, and so I've always had a passion for it. It's just I was approached by Samaritan's Purse 2.5 years ago to look at this recovery role, And initially it was going to be a program. And what we realized very quickly was that rebuilds weren't going to be part of the picture in Fort McMurray. It just didn't suit with CRA standards as well as with what Samaritan's Purse was going to be able to provide because of the cost of the rebuilds and all those types of things. And so it very quickly became clear to us that that wasn't going to be the path we would be on. So I was actually hired and with the notion of looking after the rebuilds and that part of the recovery there. And so I have a little bit of background in construction, so I'm familiar with those kind of things. I've got financial planning background, so that helped in a lot of areas as we became clear that we needed to move down a different path in terms of helping people in their recovery journey. And I think that was probably one of the first things we learned was that recovery is not an event. So rebuilding a house doesn't mean people have recovered. It just means they have a home. It's certainly a piece of recovery, but it is one piece. It's not everything. And so we kind of developed a four-prong approach to it, looking at the emotional aspect of recovery, because if people need psychological help, they're not worried about all the other pieces. So that's the first thing that we would try to get organized for them. We're not counselors. That wasn't our role, but we certainly understood all of the players in the community. We understood all of the resources that were available to people, and then we tried to link them up. And,
so
and
you're making referrals, basically.
We would make referrals. Okay. We would walk people down to make the introduction, because often people were so traumatized, they really didn't even have the wherewithal to do that. So we realized pretty quickly that a lot of the things that were being provided to people are more transactional based, and nobody was kind of taking responsibility for the overall recovery, and so nobody was coordinating and essentially quarterbacking all of those moving parts to help people get the pieces they needed when they needed them in a timely fashion. So we helped with the emotional, obviously with the physical as well, because it's an important part of their recovery. We also looked at what the financial or economic pieces were and what the resources they had to bring to bear. We took an asset-based community development approach to trying to assess what are the assets available in the community, what are the assets now that the individual has, identify what the gap was between where they were and what they would need to kind of make them whole again, and then try to bring those pieces to bear if it was appropriate. Okay. And then obviously as a Christian organization, we really took a huge interest in their spiritual recovery as well, because that's an important piece.
So, which leads me maybe to another question. Some, maybe a lot, I don't know, Canadians might say that faith-based groups have too much of a religious agenda to help people appropriately, whatever that word might mean, to appropriately recover from something which is traumatic in a crisis situation. Have you received that criticism? And what's your response to that, saying like, hey, leave these kind of things to government or non-faith-based groups that you guys shouldn't play in this arena?
Sure. You know, I think there may have been some of that initially, but the reality is in recovery, we've been very fortunate to be able to piggyback on our response folks, because certainly during our response and during our recovery, we don't only help people who are
Christians
of like-minded to us.
Yeah.
We're helping people. And so we don't make any distinction around that whatsoever, whether it's in the response or in the recovery. So it really has not been our experience, because what people have seen is that how critical that spiritual element is in people's ability to cope and their ability to recover.
And are there any other organizations, faith-based or otherwise, like the Red Cross maybe probably is the one that comes to mind the first, but does anyone have the capability that you guys have for Canadian crises like this?
No, they don't. Certainly not in the sense of looking at that relational piece. And the Red Cross does an excellent job, but their niche is more around that transaction. What do people need right now?
Okay.
How do we help them? How do we
get them the water, get the water bottles,
get them into housing, get them fed. And then with Salvation Army, they're a great partner in those areas as well. Mennonite Disaster Service is very active in rebuilds in those kind of pieces. So really our role has kind of tended to evolve into where we now, take that journey with people. We walk with them to help them based in relationship, because we're going to ask a lot of financial questions. And it's certainly pointless to help somebody in a rebuild of a home if they don't have the wherewithal to sustain it. So we want to make sure that if we're helping them get back into a home, that it's going to be both sustainable and affordable. And the last thing we want to do is use donated dollars to create an asset for a financial institution.
Okay. Lots of things we could dig down just in that statement alone. But maybe let's talk Fort McMurray, because I think we're 3 years here.
May 2nd.
Yeah, we're right there. So the images of our mind of the disaster response, cats blowing down pieces of forest and then cleaning up homes and getting rid of that stuff. Talk to us a little bit more now about recovery. So what are the specific ways that you have been working over the past 3 years to help people recover? So who are your clients that you're serving, and what kind of ways are you... You gave those four examples, whether it was counseling, the physical assets, their spiritual lives. Can you tell us a little bit? Like, it's easy to think about that a month or two later, but 3 years. Like, okay, what is the process that you're still helping with people, and maybe give us a clearer picture of what that actually looks like in Fort McMurray specifically.
Yeah, in Fort McMurray, there's still people who aren't back in their homes for a variety of reasons. Some, there's a whole complex that started, a condominium complex, and essentially it's a townhouse type complex, but the builder that they had hired to go in there, the insurance company put in place, has gone bankrupt. So now it sits with some of the, none of the places are habitable. The roads aren't finished. There's no sidewalks. There's nothing. So those people that were waiting to get back in there still can't be back in their homes.
I see.
There are people who had chosen builders. They had insurance protection, and they were moving forward, and the builder has since gone bankrupt. And so now they have given over the lion's share of their insurance proceeds and
to that contractor who
is now no more. And so trying to find ways to help those folks get back into something. People have in mind what they had as their reference point. But the reality is, in Fort McMurray especially, there were over 300 homes that had no insurance of the 2,200 that were lost. Mm-hmm. So quite a large number. And so those people with no insurance have a really hard path around trying to find resources. They have in mind that what they would like to replace is what they lost. But the reality is, we had to develop some philosophies around what would we be prepared to partner with some other organizations to offer them. And it really boiled down to safe, warm, and dry. We're not replacing what you lost. We're not an insurance company. But we will try to partner with you and other groups that are like-minded as best we can to try to get you back into a home housing solution.
So, for example, that apartment complex...
We won't be involved in that because that's still insurance. Suspect that one's going to end up in the courts, and I don't have any idea how. They've had a couple of different lawsuits and assessments and different things, so that one's going to be very complicated before it gets unpacked.
So tell me, maybe give me an example of a homeowner who the safe, warm, and dry philosophy. What have you actually done for them? How does that look, and for how long?
Well, what we have done with some of them is partnered with other organizations that do work directly in house rebuilds with Habitat for Humanity.
Okay.
So we're doing an MDS, Mennonite Disaster Service. We're doing the case management for all of them, and we're actually co-case managing with the Red Cross because we gather quite a bit of information that they don't.
Okay.
So through that, we're able to make sure as best we can that people are going to be able to get into something affordable. So it's looking at their financial statements, looking at their where their monies go, because when the Red Cross support stops, now what's their reality going to look like? How are they going to be able to move forward in a sustainable way without getting them in a position where the Red Cross is going to be trying to prop them up? But I mean, at some point, the Red Cross is going to run out of funding as well, and they're going to move on. So it's trying to find solutions for these people that, in some cases, it could be that bankruptcy is the best solution. But you know, again, that's not a call we make. But we have networked and we work with an organization to do that financial counseling piece to ensure that bankruptcy is legitimately the best way forward for them. So that's why I say it's not complicated. It's very complicated because you have to digest all of those pieces and then understand the implications, help them budget appropriately, and you can, by all the information we're able to gather, we can tell if they're going to be disciplined enough to be able to sustain a home.
Okay. So are people willing to let you in, so to speak? Like, you know, you said you have to ask personal questions about their finances and their lives. Are people open to that or resistant to that?
We get mixed responses.
Okay.
If people are legitimately intent on trying to find a solution, they will bring those things forward.
Okay.
And if they're not, as often as not, it's because they have other resources. They just don't want to reveal them. And I think if someone is going to come and help them, then they're going to take advantage of that. And if we try to dig too deeply and you know, because we want to look at least 2 years of their notice of assessment on their tax returns and those kind of things, because you have to look at the information that is going to reveal the full extent of their financial circumstance, because again, looking at that asset-based approach, if they have resources that they can bring to bear, then they should do that. Mm-hmm. This is their solution. Mm-hmm. They need to participate in it.
It's a partnership, not just a straight-out gift. It's we're working together.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in Canada, you can't gift them a home because that's classified as individual betterment.
Okay.
So you have to be very careful that you don't get crossways with CRA in going down that path, because what they really are looking at, relief of poverty or community betterment, and you know, you can say that okay, there's a benefit to the community if someone is in home, but why them as opposed to someone else?
Right.
And because of the way our tax
laws
work,
there might be other circumstances, and people go, well, I've had hard circumstances too. Why don't I qualify to get a house as well?
Yeah, and it's so interesting because you see that in other contexts in smaller communities where those kind of things come out, and then what happens is people start to resent those who are receiving benefits, and so it actually causes a divide in the community. So it's really important to try to encourage the community as best we can, you know, having very limited influence, but encouraging them that if you have a community plan and you can show how these individuals' recovery fits into your community plan, then everybody is better off. You strengthen the community, you strengthen, and you know, recovery doesn't take place at a community level, it takes place at the individual level, one individual at a time.
And I've heard, I don't know if this is true or not, but then at Fort McMurray, there's still lots of people who have not come back. Is that true?
And yes.
Do you know any numbers on how many are not back in the community that were living there before?
Well, I can tell you the numbers I've been given. They maintain that 70% of the people came back after the fire, and that 30% of the people who are there now are people who weren't there before the fire.
Okay.
So what that number actually shakes out to look like, I don't know. But, you know, the big concern in Fort McMurray now is that it's in a lot of ways become gone back to the old days of fly in, fly out.
Okay.
So they're flying into camps. They're flying. I was talking to a fellow. I was in Fort McMurray last week, and he said the traffic in the airport is down by 40%. So everybody is struggling, and so they're actually starting to try to move some of those charter flights that fly people in to work in the camps. They're going to start moving them back into the main terminal because it's not viable the way it is.
Okay.
So, you know, there's just a ripple effect that goes through all of these things that has impacts that it's impossible to plan and mitigate against.
I see. So, from what I understand, Samaritan's Purse is trying to be holistic and provide for not just the physical, emotional. What about the spiritual side? Because as Canadians, we're a little suspicious of people getting into, you know, our beliefs. Are people open as you're working with them, trying to provide support and help them rebuild their lives? Are they interested in talking about spiritual matters? Or does it really differ on the person? Is there much to do after the initial like shock of my home is gone, or what about a few years out? Is there much support to give?
Well, I think there is, and it obviously starts during the response phase, and as you mentioned earlier, the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association chaplains go in and they're involved with us in every response. And so a lot of folks are introduced to it. And if it's a fire and we go in and do sifting, trying to find any of their belongings that may have survived the fire, at the end of that, we offer them a Bible and it's signed by everyone who's worked on that home.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, we do the same thing in a flood response, and we rarely find people who will not accept that as the gift in the way it's intended. And then, so if we can open those doors at that point, then often it leads to deeper conversations. And as we go down through that path to recovery, and because we network so closely with the churches wherever we go, we always set up in a church wherever we are. We want to connect the people to the church because Samaritan's Purse's role is effectively to work ourselves out of a job. So we want the people connected to the local church.
That's
we don't
be
want
there
them
long
commuted.
After.
Yeah, we don't want them connected to Samaritan's Purse.
Okay.
So that's the approach we take. And because we're so you know, when our units show up with the 53-foot trailer with Samaritan's Purse all over the side and the Billy Graham mobile ministry unit shows up, people are very aware of who we are, what we do, and then we wear bright orange shirts just in case we get lost. But we wear bright orange shirts.
You're actually color coded, right? The volunteers and chaplains are color coded.
Yeah,
tell us about that.
The volunteers with Billy Graham Association. Well, the chaplains are all volunteers as well, but they wear blue shirts, and the Samaritan's Purse people working actively on the scenes wear orange shirts. So the blue shirts and the orange shirts are how they're lovingly referred to.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tell us maybe what's on your desk, or maybe we got to think more mobile than that. What's in your briefcase these days? So as you look to some of the things you're doing in BC, we've been talking a lot about Fort McMurray. What are you trying to do to help the communities in, let's say, what's on the agenda for this year for Grand Forks or in the Caribou? What's the practical questions you're trying to wrestle with right now?
Well, right now we've had three invitations to go in and help. One is in Bonaparte outside of Cache Creek on a First Nations reserve there.
Okay.
We have a request at the Burns Lake, Fraser Lake area after the fire there. They're looking for assistance in repairs, rebuilds, site cleanup, debris removal, those types of things.
Okay.
And then we're actively working as well in the Dees Lake area, Telegraph Creek, and an area outside of there off the reserve. The Telegraph Creek is First Nations, and then the Glenora area is outside of there. And it's just not a very easy place to get to. It's you either fly into Terrace or Smithers if you fly, and then it's a 7-hour drive to Dease Lake, and then another hour and a half into Telegraph Creek. So, and then Glenora is about half an hour out past there.
So there's like buildings that are kind of burnt and just lying on the ground that need to clean up, or
they lost over 20 homes in Telegraph Creek itself. And then in the Glenora area, they lost several homes and then outbuildings, some that were in the midst of construction. So it's just complicated. And, you know, I tell you how difficult it is to get there, because then that gives you a sense of what would be involved in getting building materials, supplies, all those types of things in there.
Okay.
So it's you know, we're looking at that. I'm waiting actually on all three of those proposals for this week to see if there's something we can do to mobilize some volunteers to help these people on their path to recovery. So it may be that type of volunteer work. If we get into the case management area where we're gonna help journey with these folks as they try to find solutions in a variety of different ways, then those will be full-time staff. And our approach there is I try to hire one person who's local. Okay. And I want to parachute someone in who's got some experience, partly because the local person obviously knows the community. They're familiar with all the pits we may fall into inadvertently. And it also, our intent is always to leave capacity behind. We want to leave people with some capacity behind, because that's how you build resilience. And and ultimately, that's what you want to do is build resilience into these communities, so the next time some type of disaster occurs, they're better able to respond on their own.
Okay. And going back to the insured question we were talking about at Fort McMurray, are these buildings in northern BC, are those non-insured things as well? So insurance companies are not involved in this stuff?
Yeah, well, and in BC, they have a little different approach. They have DFA, they have disaster funding assistance.
Okay.
And so some places are eligible. It depends on what it is, and it can get very complicated because the assessors come in, they put a value on it. It works off of what they think it's going to take to get your home back to where it was, as well if in a flooded, in an example of a flood, get your home back to where it was, and then they will provide that money. They don't have any stipulation that the funding has to go towards that. You could go buy a new vehicle if you chose to instead with the funds, but it doesn't help you with your housing problem. And in Grand Forks, it was doubly complicated because they provided the disaster funding assistance, and then there's one area that was actually flooded by the sewage lagoon, and they've decided they're not going to rebuild it, but some folks have moved in there, so they're going to try to relocate them. So it's pretty murky as to what that looks like as they try to move forward with some realistic fashion of helping people get back into homes in a new area. You know, the social issues, the psychological issues around moving someone who maybe lived there. There's one family there that I'm aware of that they actually bought their parents' house, the house that she had grown up in, and she's 80. Oh.
She doesn't know anything else.
She doesn't know anything else. She can walk to downtown, all those kind of things. Now the area they're looking at moving all these folks to is outside of that. So how do they recover? How do they actually move forward in a way that gives them some quality of life that's familiar and similar to what they had?
So in our mind, and in my mind, these are questions that the government usually is answering. You're at their invitation, giving some advice based on what you've seen before, or
yes,
okay,
yeah, based on what we've seen before, as well as typically the people tasked with recovery don't have any experience, and unfortunately, many times they're actually the ones who have been traumatized by the disaster, and then to put this on their shoulders to try to come up with some kind of a recovery plan and a solution that is viewed as being equitable and reasonable is almost too much for them to bear. And so we do a lot of kind of coaching and counseling in that. So I spend quite a bit of time just, even if we don't go in and get directly engaged in giving those people some heads up what they can expect. Here's the timelines. Here's the different stages that people are going to experience. You know, a large part of any kind of a disaster is there will be triggers coming down the road. And, you know, in a fire, then a trigger may be just a campfire. It may be that there's a little fire outside of town and everybody's panicked.
Because they can smell smoke.
They can smell smoke. And last time I was evacuated 3 weeks, I had no time to pack anything up, you know, so now they've got themselves an emergency bag packed. And so it takes a long time for people to get over those kind of triggers.
Going back to the partnership with the local church, I don't know. Do you have any stories where you've seen, this is my field, I'm interested in the local church. Do you have any stories of a church in one of the communities you've been working with that has really risen to the occasion, not only in the midst of the crisis, but following? Like, what, do you have any stories you can tell that way?
You know, every church that we get involved with has risen to the occasion, certainly during the response, because we will usually inundate them for as much as 2 months.
Okay, like taking over their facility.
We're taking over. And so, you know, it may be in Fort McMurray, we were in the Fort City Church, which is an Alliance Church there, and we, you know, slept in a gym there with 40 of my closest friends. So, you know, then it really interrupts all of their regular programming, all the kind of things they try to do. It's interesting because, you know, my experience that I've figured out so far from what I've been involved with is that the church wants to help out. And so they want to get engaged in doing something. What happens, though, is then there's nobody to be the church. Because they're acting like
a relief organization
instead of acting like the church. And so it's a matter of trying to help them understand. And so we're actually in the process of trying to capture some of these things that we've learned and write them down. We've brought someone on board to capture all this stuff and write it down, create a bit of a curriculum so that we can be consistent in what we do, that we can do it in a way that allows people to take some of these tools and just plug them in terms of understanding what their community assets are, understanding what their community looks like. How do you actually even define your community and then helping them move forward through those processes. So we're trying to get some kind of plug and play things where there's PowerPoints that we're creating for the government level, for the church level, for the community level, and then ideally on an individual, then we can do some one-on-one things. But so it's you know, the church is always involved. We're still very actively involved with the churches in Fort McMurray, and some of it is you know, we have the benefit of seeing what happens across Canada and across U.S. and actually throughout the world. So what kind of things are we aware of that we can bring that they can plug in and do that will now help them and help their congregation and then attract others, obviously, to come and see what that Christian experience is all about.
So you're saying a church may say, "Look, we just want to get out. We want to clean out basements. We want to shovel ashes." And you're saying, in some cases, that may not be the best thing that you can do to serve this community.
It may well be, and it may be that, you know, you have some volunteers who are uniquely qualified to do those kind of things. Doesn't mean you shouldn't be involved in it.
Okay.
But it shouldn't become your focus of looking like another relief organization. There's still an important role for the church, and the church is going to have lots of people who are hurting and need help and healing within. And so identify those people, because as much as we feel like we've got a leg up because of our faith, we also still have to process all of this stuff and deal with it in a way that allows us to actually become more resilient and continue to be effective in our community.
Okay, so you would say don't forget about the soft issues of just people dealing with grief, with loss.
Absolutely.
The relational things of friendships and
support
and meals and stuff we do all the time, not just during a disaster.
Right, and you know, check in on your neighbors and see because not everybody recovers the same way. And so checking in on them and understand that because things appear good on the surface doesn't mean that they are. And it's interesting. They say that the PTSD will set in anywhere from 24 to 36 months after a disaster.
Wow.
And it manifests itself in family violence, in divorce, it acts out in kids. Kids are affected completely differently in there. Mm. Don't forget your children, you know, that they may appear to be all right, but they don't know how to process these things. They haven't, they're not accustomed to seeing their parents who've been frightened.
Rock steady.
And
Yeah.
Now they've been scared because they had to evacuate and all this is out of their control. Mm. So, you know, it's really important to look to those kind of things. And I think that's where the church can really, really be significant in those families and understand who they are. And then if everyone in the congregation is looking in on their neighbors, well, you multiply that out hugely. And so now we do a good job, I think, of being the church.
Okay. Well, that's maybe a good lead into my next question then. Most of the people that might be listening to us chat here don't work for organizations. They're not going to be spearheading recovery efforts like you. They're average people who might either go through a disaster someday or might be neighbors of people who go through something. What advice would you give a person if either they go through something like this themselves or they're seeking to be good friends of people who have gone through something traumatic like a fire or a flood or a tornado?
Well, I think it's understanding that what you see on the surface may not be what people are actually experiencing.
Okay.
And understanding that a lot of this stuff isn't going to manifest itself right away, and you can see some of the literature talks about there's a bit of a hero phase where you're responding right after, and you know you're doing what you can, you're rebuilding, and all these things, but it doesn't mean that you're actually on recovering in a healthy way, and so it's being aware, as I said, of what that might look like. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of literature out there on this. It's relatively new in Canada, and that's why we're trying to put some of these things together in a fashion that will be made available to churches. If something's gone on here, here's what people can expect. Yep. Here's the timelines that are going to be significant in them. What kind of things make sense on anniversaries at work that don't celebrate the event, but acknowledge it and
celebrate the good things that happened in the midst of something really horrible.
Well, and bringing people together in community, because again, it is about that notion of community, and we've chosen to organize ourselves that way by and large. So it's really important to make sure that we support community and that we give people opportunities to come together to tell our story, because often it's not about you telling them anything. It's not about you fixing it. It's just about them having an opportunity to share and tell their story.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe let me try to delve into you yourself as a man. The career you had immediately before this one was one where you were serving people in the financial services industry.
Yes.
In transitioning into this kind of work, was it just as you served and tried out some stuff and found that you had a passion and you were good at some of it? How did God lead you from something that looked quite different, talking about saving for retirement and life insurance, to where you're talking to someone about how to rebuild their community after a disaster?
And you know, I've reflected on it quite often because it's surprised me how much overlap there has been, because really in my previous life, as you said, my whole notion around financial planning was it's intended to create options given that we can't see the future.
Yep.
This is kind of the same thing. Mm. What we're trying to do is help people find options that are both affordable and sustainable and are going to move them to where they want to be. So helping understand what their plans are, understand what their goals are, and then helping them have things in place as best we can to help them move down that path. So the overlap has been amazing. And then, as I said earlier, we started out, it was going to be rebuild, so we thought that was going to be pretty straightforward. And as it evolved, it became more and more clear that that financial piece was going to be really important, because how do you legitimize what people's needs are? How do you vet people who mm-hmm. can afford to solve their own problems? Because not having insurance, in certainly in the Fort McMurray context, was by and large a choice. Mm. It wasn't driven by lack of income or anything mm-hmm. else. They weren't making choices whether they fed their kids or whether they bought insurance. They just didn't have it.
Okay.
So in that context, I think it becomes really important that we be good stewards of donated dollars.
Yes.
And so it was incumbent upon me essentially to develop a procedure or protocol that we could use consistently and that was fair, that would help us identify people who needed help, they had legitimate needs, and that they were going to be able then going forward to sustain whatever solution was brought. And so it really took me by surprise that the overlap was that great. And mm. then I think the other part of it was because this happened over several months, this realization, and then the need to kind of broadcast that to the other NGOs we were working with, it became obvious that we didn't know what we were doing. Mm. And so having to trust God to bring the people, to bring these things into clarity so that we could make sure that we made responsible decisions that were founded in good stewardship. Mm-hmm.
So you would say that actually the previous careers, even though on the surface it might seem, man, these are completely different things, that actually God was preparing you quite well for this latest
yes.
career.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. I mean, it's just become so clear to me that you know, with networking, doing those kind of things, going into communities, talking to the community leaders and meeting with the provincial governments and all those kind of things have become an important part of this whole role. And the better we can do that so that the provinces actually own the recovery program, mm-hmm. then we then can be one of the people who legitimately partner with them to mm-hmm. deliver some of these things, as opposed to, because of the long-term nature of recovery, if you think of 2 to 10 years, well, there has to be some reliability of funding. Because if you can't commit to something for 2 to 5 years, if you don't have government funding, that's really the only way that it can come back to pass. Because once the honeymoon period is over and people have moved on to the next event that's happened anywhere else in the world because mm-hmm. of the way our 24-hour mm-hmm. news cycle goes, then people forget. Mm. But the people who have been impacted still have not recovered.
I see.
And so it's trying to help them understand the scope of recovery, understanding what the costs of it are, and helping them understand that we have an important role to play, especially because of the spiritual piece that we can bring to the table in such a people-friendly fashion.
Mm-hmm. Cool. How have you changed as a guy? What's changed about you personally as a result of this work?
Oh, you know, it's been interesting in a lot of ways. One of the things that probably keeps me up the most is looking at what's down the road, and I kind of feel like my responsibility is to find someone to come behind me, because I don't have that many 5-year plans left. Mm. And so trying to get someone who can take this on, because I see this as becoming more and more important, because as you said earlier, there seems to be more and more of these disasters occurring. Well, that means there's going to be more recoveries and fewer resources, so they're going to have to be used more wisely. Mm. So it's going to become really important that we become a legitimate influencer in where this goes and how it goes.
Mm. And your outlook on human beings? Are you more optimistic or pessimistic person after working in this field?
I am more optimistic because I'm amazed at how many people that we come across who's come to see what kind of support we're able to offer. And when we kind of explain to them what it is, what the mandate is, how this might look, it's amazing how many times people say, well, you know what? There's other people who need it more than I do.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not always that people just have a handout to take whatever they can get?
No, some do, but that's more the exception than the rule. Mm. It's really far more often it's people coming and saying, well, you know, there's others who need it more than I do. I can probably make out. And you know, so it's really, it's been really encouraging in that regard.
Mm. So let's say someone listening hears a little bit about maybe especially the disaster response and says to themselves, man, I'd really like to get involved. I'd love to do some of that if the opportunity arose. How does one get involved and get trained up so that they might be called when the time comes?
Yeah, you know, go to SamaritanPurse.ca. And there's all kinds of information there. There's online applications, and then someone will follow up with you and make sure that that there are areas to serve. It's, as I said before, with the rapid response team on the Billy Graham side as well. Mm. So if your inclination is more towards the journeying with people on a spiritual level as opposed to doing the physical or the heavy lifting type work, then there's opportunities on both. And we're always looking for good people. We have lots of good training, and we build into our people because we know that we're only as good as our people.
Yeah.
And Samaritan's Purse has a great reputation out there. We're always one of the very first invited in. And they want us on the ground, and they want us leading the volunteers because they know we have the training protocols in place, that we have the personal protective equipment and all those pieces in place.
Hmm. So it'll be a well-managed team whenever they show up?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. And they can fit in whatever capacity they have. And, you know, as I said earlier, just with the churches that we work with, it's so critical because they feed us. When we're there on the ground with all of our volunteers, often they'll house us. We sleep there. You got all these smelly bodies around. And so, you know, it's just a great, great partnership. And you can see it's God's church and God is at work.
Cool. Steve, thanks for taking the time to sit with us. Tell us a little bit about what's behind the scenes. And I know every time I talk to you, I'm amazed at how complex these issues are, and it's neat to see someone like yourself who knows Jesus and has a lot professionally and personally speaking. Thanks for representing us in situations where people need expertise and someone who cares.
Well, thank you, Jason, and thanks for getting this out there. I think it's really important for people to understand.
Cool.
Everybody has a role to play.
Absolutely. If you want to know a little bit more about what Samaritan's Purse does or get linked to some of the things that Steve mentioned to, please make sure to check out our website, CochraneAlliance.com/real, and you'll be able to find out some of the information you're looking for. So thanks for joining us today, and keep it real.
Thanks for listening to The Real Podcast. For more information on this episode and others, check out our website at CochraneAlliance.com/real. Until next time, keep it real.